And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon. Well, this hour we visit with journalist and author John Glatt. He tells the tale of Miami Beach's Novak family. Patriarch Ben Novak's crowning achievement was the fabulous Fontainebleau Hotel, the beach's most famous destination. But long after the hotel had changed hands, Ben Novak's ex-wife and only son were murdered in 2009. It's been a sensational case in that Ben Novak's ex-stripper wife was behind the slaughters and was convicted. The book is The Prince of Paradise, the true story of a hotel heir, his seductive wife, and a ruthless murder. And John Glatt joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome to you, John. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you. You know, I read your book last Saturday. It disturbed me greatly. It continues to, which led me to wonder about you and when you write these books like Prince of Paradise, how it impacts you and your psyche and for how long?
Yes, well, I found it very disturbing, too. In fact, I covered the complete trial for 2 months, which nothing before had prepared me for that trial and the kind of horrors that the jury saw. And I did have a few sleepless nights during it.
So do you have to separate yourself emotionally from what you're investigating in cases like this?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've done a number of true crimes. And after this one, in fact, I'm now doing a music book just to get away from things for a while.
I can imagine.
John Glatt, give us the history of the property on Collins Avenue where the Fontainebleau was constructed. It was once the Harvey Firestone estate.
Right.
More history behind it. And how Ben Novak got control of it.
Well, Ben Novak had a hotel over the road, I think the Sans Souci.
Right.
And when the Firestone estate was sold, he wanted to buy it. But I think there was a zoning prohibition against hotels because they were already because it was in a fashionable part of Miami Beach and they didn't want any more hotels. So Ben Novak spent quite a lot of time rallying to get the zoning changed. And finally, with some partners, he managed to buy the land and came up with the plans for the Fontainebleau.
And give us a little history of how he built this Miami Beach landmark. It was quite a thing at the time.
Oh, it was amazing. In fact, he enlisted an architect called Maurice Lapidou from New York, who, in fact, had never done a hotel before. And Ben had met him many years before, quite casually, because Lapidou mainly designed department stores, entrances, and Ben Novak had the idea that that was the idea that he wanted to bring to the Fontainebleau, to give it kind of this otherworldly effect. So he enlisted Maurice Lapidou, who came up with the amazing design of the Fontainebleau, the wave and everything, which is quite iconic even now.
Although there was some controversy over that. Ben Novak Sr. said he came up with it.
In the bathroom. Absolutely. While sitting on the throne.
Right.
Yes. That's right. And they were arguing forever on that. In fact, nearly 50 years later, Ben Novak's ex-wife and widow was still sort of sticking to the story that Ben came up with it on the throne and Maurice Lapidou was merely an upstart.
Right. Do you want to move on? Do we want to stay on the Fontainebleau or do we want to move on to Ben Novak Jr.?
And Bernice Drazen.
And Bernice Drazen.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So tell us about Bernice Drazen. That was his wife and tell us
That's
a little
right.
about her.
That's
right. A famous model.
Yeah. Bernice Drazen was like a supermodel of her time in the 40s. She came from a broken childhood. Parents were divorced. She had a sister, Maxine. They were very, very close. And after the divorce, Bernice and Maxine were sent to stay with relatives, and eventually they were fostered out. They had a very difficult time. They were both strikingly beautiful with red hair and everything. And when they were quite young, an uncle suggested that they modeled. So I think it was one of the local department stores hired them to do some glove modeling and things at the beginning. And Bernice, I guess, got bitten by the bug, and as she grew up, she found herself as a model and was very, very well sought after.
And at first she resisted the Ben Novak Sr. and his advances, but then eventually she gave in.
That's right. I mean, he ardently pursued her for about a year. They were both married at the time. Bernice was married to Archie Drazen, who was away fighting the Second World War, and Ben's wife at the time was back in Miami, and they met in a New York nightclub, and Ben immediately struck up a conversation with Bernice, who really wasn't that impressed, because Ben was very, very deaf after a childhood accident and always had a hearing aid, and he had found it very, very difficult to carry on a conversation, especially with the loud background noise. So Bernice, you know, wondered who this... She saw him as middle-aged and had no real romantic interest in Ben, but he just ardently pursued her for many months.
Paint us a picture of the Fontainebleau in its heyday with the Rat Pack and Elvis Presley and JFK and all of the tremendous entertainers that stayed there.
Well, I think the Fontainebleau was really in its heyday. The 60s and up to the mid-70s was really the center of celebrities. I mean, everybody performed there. The Rat Pack were regulars. Frank Sinatra, in fact, was a very, very close friend with Ben Novak Sr. and had been given his own suite on the 17th floor, I think. And he would come and go, and in exchange, he would perform there, you know, three or four times a year. So, you know, he was synonymous very much with the Fontainebleau. And with him, he brought the Rat Pack, and they would have some legendary, you know, performances in the Le Ronde Room. It was also very famous because Jerry Lewis filmed his movie The Bellboy there. And later, James Bond movie Goldfinger was filmed at the swimming pool. And Frank Sinatra did several films there. So it was very, very synonymous with glamour. And all the biggest stars played there.
So they had their son, Ben Novak Jr., and he grew up in a very unusual circumstances in a Fontainebleau penthouse and had a most unhappy childhood. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, his parents were really not naturally inclined towards parenthood. You know, his father was working pretty much 24/7 on running the hotel and everything, and his mother was really not that maternal. So poor Ben found himself being looked after by a rather crusty German nanny, I was told by his aunt Maxine, that would kind of almost force-feed him food he didn't like. And his family became like this, you know, the housekeepers and cooks at the Fontainebleau. And, you know, he grew up with room service. You know, that's what he was used to. He had no friends his own age. Whenever he had a birthday, they'd have parties and they'd trot out some children of guests to come and, you know, celebrate with him. But really, he had no sort of family life or warmth from his parents. He also became, you know, interestingly enough, pretty close to some of the entertainers. I mean, Frank Sinatra was growing up like an uncle, and Anne Margaret was also very close, and they would pamper the little boy. But his aunt Maxine, you know, suggested the title for my book, actually. She called him the Prince of the Fontainebleau.
Although he wasn't particularly well-liked, it seems, and then he had that terrible speech impediment because you said the nanny tried to get him to become right-handed, and he was actually left-handed, and that may have caused it.
Correct. That's what his aunt Maxine thinks, that, you know, because of this... the nanny, she had a very derogatory effect on Ben, and he had a terrible stammer right from the beginning. He could hardly get his words out, and it would take him many years, well into adulthood, before he could conquer it.
I was impressed that while Ben Novak owned the hotel, the Fontainebleau never had a sign on it. His theory was that everybody knows what the Fontainebleau is.
Absolutely, yeah. He thought it spoke for itself, and it was world famous. He didn't consider it ever needed a sign. And later on, I mean, after it was sold, the first thing they did was put up a sign saying the Fontainebleau outside, and Ben ridiculed that.
So he also developed a relationship with a lot of the Miami Beach cops that were staying there, and then became a reservist himself.
Absolutely. I mean,
Junior.
Yeah. I mean, growing up as a little kid, he idolized the police. I mean, Ben Novak Sr., and in fact, enlisted a lot of the Miami Beach cops into Moonlight, and he gave them certain perks, you know, in return for security. So Ben Jr. got to know them. In fact, they called him Benji all this time growing up. And Benji got to know and befriend the cops, and those were really the only friends he had, because he didn't have any friends his own age, so the cops kind of adopted him. And I was told, I mean, some of them generally liked him, but in a lot of cases, it was because the cops wanted to, you know, garner favor with Ben Sr. for certain perks they would get. So it was a strange relationship, but that was, you know, Ben's friends, really, growing up.
We're speaking with John Glad. He's an investigative journalist and author of The Prince of Paradise on today's Topical Currents. It's all about the Novak family. And we need to take a short break. We'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with John Glatt. He's the author of The Prince of Paradise. And as Bonnie said earlier, it's about the Novak family and the historic Fontainebleau Hotel and some gruesome murders that ensued. John Glatt, when I was looking in through the book and the pictures, Junior's first wife, Jill, she was 6 feet tall, is gorgeous blonde. She kind of reminded me a little bit like Shelley Long, who played the waitress on Cheers, if you're at all familiar with her.
Yes, there was a great similarity. Their faces are very similar, mm-hmm. in fact. Yeah. Well, Ben was actually set up with Jill by one of his policeman friends, who thought they would make a good couple, because Ben was... you know, he was a playboy from a very early age. And I mean, growing up at the Fontainebleau, there was a lot of rather dubious goings on with women and things. So Ben always had a lot of girlfriends of one way or another. And one of his policeman friends, Pete, decided that, you know, he should meet this very nice girl who'd in fact been a Las Vegas dancer, but was a daughter of one of his neighbors. So he told Ben, and Ben invited her, in fact, to come to the Fontainebleau to interview for a job. And it was a pretext, in fact, because he wanted to date her. So after going through quite a lengthy interview with Jill, she said, "Have I got the job?" We said, "No, you haven't, because I want to date you, and you can't work here if you date the boss." So it went from there, really.
So how long was he married to Jill?
He was married to Jill, I think, just over a year and a half. It was basically Ben Jr.'s mother, Bernice, was a you know, a hands-on Jewish mother, and no girl was ever going to be good enough. Jill wasn't Jewish, and they didn't really get on. In fact, what nobody knew at the time was that Ben, when he got married, was 21. Jill was, in fact, 28, but Ben Jr. had told Jill that he'd added about 7-8 years onto his age. He'd padded it to make himself look older. And as he had a bushy beard, he did look older. And it was only after they were married that, in fact, she found out that he was a lot younger than she thought he was. And she was quite astounded by this. And afterwards, I mean, she told me when I interviewed her that she figures that's why Bernice never approved of her, too, because, you know, she was seen as the older woman when she had no idea of it at the time.
Right.
Well, when that marriage ended, then Ben seemed to be running with the wrong crowd. Perhaps he was involved in drug usage. And he winds up meeting his next wife, who is a dancer at the Follies International.
Correct.
Not exactly the classiest place. It's in Hialeah out. It was in Hialeah out on Okeechobee Road.
That's right, yes.
And tell us about that.
Yeah, well, he was in fact brought there by one of his Miami Beach police friends who was doing, you know, whose part of his job was supervising the strip clubs. So Ben became a regular there, and the Follies was kind of quite a rough strip club. It wasn't very upmarket, and... I interviewed another stripper there who told me about when Ben first met, and she was known in those days was Sylvia. She was a young red-headed Ecuadorian stripper. Her English wasn't that great, but Ben certainly took a liking to her. And Sylvia asked the other girls who this guy was, who seemed, you know, very well and a good tipper. And they said that his father owned, you know, the Fontainebleau, was very rich. And the next time he came in, Sylvia gave him special treatment. And the next thing, she was dating him and she'd left the Follies.
And how long did they go out before they were married? And their relationship was pretty rocky from the outset, wasn't it?
Right from the beginning, yeah. I mean, they were both Sylvia. Well, her real name was Narcy Veliz, in fact. But she was very, very possessive, you know, with Ben, because I figure she knew kind of that he liked to play around. So she was always jealous that there'd be other, you know, girlfriends in sight. And even before they got married, I was told they were on a boat together, and she got suspicious. She was at home and she'd found something. And she called up Ben, who was on a boat with a policeman friend of his, Charlie Cereda, and said she was going to burn down the house because he was having an affair, and Ben had to sort of talk her down from that. And Charlie said he knew right from there they had a rocky path going.
Right. And so they got married and they had quite a prenuptial agreement.
Yeah. Yes. And I mean, Ben was, you know, he was very canny. He by that time, he'd started out in business on his own. His father, Ben Sr., who'd in fact lost the Fontainebleau by then, had died. And Ben was making money as a organizing conferences for Anway. And he was probably was well up to a millionaire by that point. He had money. And when they got married, he did a very cast-iron prenuptial agreement. So if they ever divorced, Narcy wasn't going to get very much money. She certainly wasn't going to get the Fontainebleau fortune.
And it was that she was going to get very little, and she had a daughter, her daughter May Abad, and wasn't she
right.
slated to get a little something?
But at that point, no. I mean, May Abad was back in Brooklyn with an uncle. She was living with Narcy's brother, Cristobal, who lived in Brooklyn, because basically either Narcy or Ben really had any room for a little, I think she was like a 6 or 7 year old girl in their lives. So she was sort of shipped off around the Veliz family for the next few years. And she would come and visit occasionally in the summer, but they were never very close at that point.
So what year was this that they got married?
They got married, I think, in 1983.
Oh, 83.
Yeah, they've been dating about, I think, 6 or 7 years.
Okay. So then we get to June of 2002 and that bizarre home invasion. Do you want to tell us about that?
Oh, yes. I mean, by that time, the relationship had kind of progressed nearly 20 years, I think. And it was always very, very volatile, always tempestuous. Ben had become a multimillionaire by that time, and he had people helping him and, you know, run things, but he had a certain gopher that would organize things. And he usually had a couple of girlfriends on the side that he'd put up, you know, around the Fort Lauderdale area in love shacks, I guess, and come and visit them. And around then, Narcy had feared that Ben was going to leave her for one of these women, and that she was going to get cut out of the will. So in order to teach him a lesson, she organized a home invasion. Nobody quite knows how many people were hired, but one night after they went out, I think it was a Saturday night, they went to bed, and the next thing Ben knew, a couple of men burst in and started pistol whipping him. His face, hog-tied him up from a chair. And basically, they held him hostage for about 28 hours. And they was blindfolded, but he could hear Narcy giving them orders. And she really ransacked the whole house. She took everything. She took a lot of Batman memorabilia that she was collecting. And she also took nearly $400,000 in cash that were kept in, you know, several safety deposit boxes scattered around the house. And then when she was leaving, she told Ben This is what's going to... You're lucky you're still alive because they would have killed you. I'm the only one that saved your life. So you better watch out or else. And then she left and she called up a neighbour to come and free him. And the first thing Ben did, in fact, was to call his mother, who was then in her early 80s, to come and rescue him. And then the police were called.
And then what happened to Narcy? Was she ever charged with anything?
No, Narcy wasn't. I mean, there was an investigation by Fort Lauderdale detectives, but Ben was very kind of secretive. He didn't want them to be too overt because he said there was kind of, there was mobsters involved and everything, but he said Narcy was behind it. But then when Narcy was called in for questioning, she arrived at Fort Lauderdale police station with a bag, with an accordion briefcase that she'd bought, and she opened it up, and she in fact had pictures of Ben's he had a collection of amputee pictures of young women which dated back from his days as a teenager at the Fontainebleau, and Narcy put them on the desk, and the police didn't they were shocked, and they'd never seen anything like this. And then eventually one of the detectives called Ben, and Ben said, did Narcy show you anything? And when they said yes and he realized they'd seen this, he called off everything, called off the police investigation. He'd in fact seen a law about getting a divorce. That was all forgotten. And to the surprise of many of his friends and to the shock and bewilderment, he then took Narcy back and she went back to live with him as if nothing had happened.
You mentioned he collected Batman memorabilia. That's yeah. really kind of terming it lightly. He probably had more than anyone in the world and even had a replica of the Batman car.
Correct. Well, he started off around that time. He started off small, but then he got consumed with Batman memorabilia. He did it secretly at first, contacting all these different dealers and buying anything he could with Batman on. And every day, you know, there'd be these huge packages from FedEx with different comics and Batman memorabilia like watches and everything, and he would collect everything and anything, and he'd store them in his offices, which was, you know, in his compound in Fort Lauderdale, and his dream was to have a Batman museum. And eventually, you know, it was estimated that he was probably the second biggest Batman collector in the world. And in fact, his pride and joy was a Batmobile, which he had specially designed from the original molds that the 60s television Batmobile was done from. And that was delivered just a short time before he died. He only ever got to drive it once. Mm.
Tell us about the relationship between Narcy Novak and her mother-in-law, Bernice.
Oh, well, that was always fraught from the beginning. I mean, Bernice was never going to like any girlfriend or wife of Ben Jr., who she doted on, and especially, you know, an Ecuadorian stripper, and they did not hit it off. It was only after they got married and Bernice realized that she was going to have to live with this situation that she decided to make the most and try and get on with Narcy as best she could. Now, Ben ran his operation. It was he booked conferences. I had a big company there, Convention International, from another house on his compound in Fort Lauderdale. And they all worked together. I mean, Bernice Novak, his mother, worked in one room, and she was like the treasurer and one of the presidents. Narcy was, in fact, a paid employee and worked in another room. So they would see each other every day, and they had a difficult relationship.
And, you know, you mentioned some about his women, but he had many women during his marriage to Narcy. But for some reason, when she learned of the Rebecca Bliss affair, she was livid. Narcy was. What happened that got her so upset about that particular affair?
Well, I think she realized that this was the real threat, and Ben really probably had fallen in love with Rebecca Bliss. I should point out, Rebecca Bliss was a stripper. Also, she was an exotic dancer, a stripper, also a self-confessed prostitute. She was also, her thing was tattoos. She was been a tattoo artist, and she was covered head to toe in tattoos.
We just saw a color picture of her. She was some piece of work.
Absolutely. I mean, she passed herself off as Lebanese. She wasn't. She was, in fact, I think she was from the Midwest. And her professional name was Mona Love. She made porn videos, and Later on, she became an escort. And when she moved to the Miami Beach area, she put an advert in one of the local escort magazines, and Ben Jr. picked up on it, and they met. First of all, they met just for sex, but after a couple of meetings, Ben Jr. suddenly, you know, took a big interest in her and seemed to have fallen in love. He then invited her to move to Fort Lauderdale, and he secretly had his henchman, a guy called Joe Gandy, find her an apartment. I think it was the Marina of the Falls, a very plush apartment, which he set her up in and paid the rent. And it was, in fact, Bernice, I think, that found some of the furniture bills, because Ben was paying for all her furniture, all her stuff, so she wouldn't have to carry on as an escort. And she started a new life as a DJ. But one day, Bernice found some furniture bills, and that's when Narcy realized what was going on, that Ben had this new woman, Rebecca Bliss, and she decided to go out and try and destroy the relationship.
And what did she do?
Well, first of all, she tracked down Rebecca Bliss, and she started calling her up and confronted her and said, "You'll never have Ben. You know, he's married. I'm Mrs. Novak. You'll never have Ben." And she offered her $10,000 just to walk out and leave Ben and never see him again. And Rebecca refused and told her that she was in love with Ben and money wasn't going to buy her off. And Narcy, it came up at trial when Rebecca testified. She said that Narcy told her that Ben will never leave her alive, something like that.
Something we didn't touch on, John Glatt, was some of the mm-hmm. sexual obsessions that the Novaks mm-hmm. had. A lot of bondage and S&M carrying on, correct?
Yeah. I mean, they were very much into bondage and S&M. They would tie each other up and leave each other for many hours at a time, you know, helpless. And that seemed to be Ben's kick. He really seemed to enjoy that bondage thing. And they were always traveling on this, you know, the convention business. And they would take gown robes and use the belts from those to string each other up, you know, in hotel rooms. It was a very, very strange relationship. But, I mean, it seemed to work for them for a while.
So when did Narcy, enlisting the help of her brother Christabel, decide to kill Ben Jr. and his mother Bernice?
The mother first, of course.
Yes.
That's right. That's around the end of 2008. Narcy had done a lot of, I mean, she'd really turned spy, and she'd hunted down numbers for Rebecca's family, her mother, her boyfriend, and she'd also found out the number of the landlord of this love nest that Ben had set her up in. And Narcy called her one day and said that, "I just want you to know, Mr. Ben Novak has died. I'm his widow, and he won't be paying any more rent," which was crazy because, you know, Ben was still alive. And Narcy was trying to do everything. She'd even gone to the FBI and accused him of trafficking in illegal marriages and bringing, girls in to marry foreigners illegally for their green cards, and given Rebecca's name and another girl as some of the participants. And when the FBI didn't take her seriously or anything, she finally resorted to violence, and she enlisted her brother Christabel, who had always been close to her, to help her plan it.
Okay, and then this is Bernice's death, but a week before her death, she had a fall. And greatly affected the investigation into her death. So tell us about how she was killed and how that fall affected the investigation.
Yeah, I mean, once Christabel had come to Miami Beach and he enlisted several kind of street people that he'd met at a car wash in downtown Miami, a very rough area. And they'd spent like several weeks kind of trying to follow Bernice's car back from Ben's office to her home on a golf course. It's about 10 miles away. And she was getting wind of something. And on one occasion, they actually were coming to attack her. They couldn't find her. And they threw something through the window. It was like a garden frog through the front window. And Bernice was very, very worried, and she thought somebody was following her. But Ben told her not to go to the police or anything. It was probably her imagination. Then about a week before she actually died, she was going to her bank in Fort Lauderdale when she tripped on a broken curbstone and fell over and was really badly shaken. Her face was really bruised and beaten, and she was in a bad state. By that time, she was 86. She was very, very good condition, but for an 86-year-old woman to fall, it was a very big shock. And in fact, Ben was already taking photographs and thinking of suing the bank because he was quite litigious.
Right. And then on April 4th, the gruesome murder took place. What happened?
Yeah, well, this was probably about the fourth or fifth attempt to do this, you know, by Cristobal with his, you know, his henchmen. They'd kind of convened around near Bernice's house that day. She hadn't been feeling well. She'd stayed at home. She'd in fact, settled down in front of the television with a glass of white wine. And I think, as was her custom, which prosecutors say that Cristobal and his henchmen have been fully briefed on by Narcy, Bernice had gone out to park the car. Unknown to her, Alexandro Gutierrez, which is Garcia, which is one of the henchmen of 6 foot tall, 220-pound giant with a bad eye, very,
really
very intimidating,
yeah,
had crept up behind her as she went to park the car, holding a monkey wrench, and slammed it down over her face, hit her repeatedly till she was unconscious, and then left her in her car, you know, to die, basically. He thought she was dead. In fact, she wasn't. The poor woman came to, and she crawled out of the car, and she crawled through her garage into her house. She must have been, I can't imagine what was going through. I mean, she was in a terrible, terrible state. She had a cracked skull, broken bones, blood everywhere. And she went to try and change her clothes to go, they think, maybe to go to hospital because, you know, she was covered in blood and, you know, she was a very proper lady then. And on her way out, as she was trying to pull an emergency cord, she fell down and died. And that's where she was found. And when police found her, Fort Lauderdale police, they naturally assumed that because she'd fallen down and had this accident a week earlier, that this is probably what happened. And the detective investigating theorized that she'd probably fallen down in her car because there was some blood there on the outside and the steering wheel, and then been crawling back into the house. And it was kind of, it was made an accidental death. That's how it was, that's how the coroner, you know, wrote it down as an accidental death. But a lot of people were very suspicious that it wasn't.
Yeah, perhaps I've seen too much CSI, but it seems like medical examiners can easily tell the difference between someone being struck in the head by a wrench or by falling on into concrete.
Yeah, it was pretty outrageous that they ruled it an accident. Her sister, Maxine Feel, was tremendously up in arms about it, as were other people, as you said.
Yeah, I mean, Maxine never believed it was an accident. She always, from conversations with Bernice, you know, she had her suspicions about Narcy, as did a lot of other people. In fact, they all knew about the 2002 home invasion and what Narcy was capable of. And they theorized that it was probably Narcy. And they, in fact, tried to trap Narcy. It's one of the things I've got in my book, Prince of Paradise, in how Maxine and her daughter would get Narcy engaged in long conversations on the phone because Narcy liked to talk. And they try and get her to incriminate herself over the next year and try and get ammunition, you know, against her. In fact, Maxine did make a trip to Miami Beach to try and campaign to have the case reopened into Bernice's death. But at that point, it wasn't successful.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, that's 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Email, that's radio@WLRN.org. We're speaking with author John Glatt. His book is The Prince of Paradise, The True Story of a Hotel Heir, His Seductive Wife, and a ruthless murder. John Glad, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
Yeah, I've got a website, just been upgraded, actually. It's www.johnglatt.com. That's J-O-H-N, G for George, L-A-T-T.com. And it's got all my books that I've done and some reviews on The Prince of Paradise.
And also we'll have a link on the Topical Currents Facebook page to that book.
Thank you. Great.
Which brings us to July 2009, which is just 3 months after the death of Bernice, when Narcy and her brother orchestrated the grisly murder of Ben Jr. In New York. What happened there?
I mean, by that time, they thought they'd done the first hurdle, which was killing Bernice, because in order for Narcy to inherit the fortune, which was estimated around $10 million, she knew she had to kill Bernice first because Bernice would inherit it from Ben. Now Bernice was gone, it was time to turn their attention to Ben. And they thought they'd gotten away literally with murder. And they decided because it had been ruled accidental. I mean, it's amazing. But they decided that they should probably kill Ben, not in Florida, somewhere way far away to make it, much harder for them to get caught. So Ben was doing conferences for Amway, and there was a conference booked in July at the Rytown Hilton in Rybrook, New York, which they were going to go down on Thursday, and they were going to spend the next 4 days running this big, it was actually a Hispanic-speaking conference, and Narcy was very involved in the planning and everything. And it was decided that that's where the murder would take place. And in fact, Garcia, who one of the hitman that had killed Bernice, had enlisted somebody else at the car wash called Joel Gonzalez to help him on this one. And there were several trips back and forth from Miami to New York to acclimatize the two hitmen to the hotel, let them inside so they could get a good look of the whereabouts and see where cameras were, surveillance cameras, so they could go in and out without being seen.
We're speaking with a hard place to stop, but we have to take a little break. John Glad is the author of The Prince of Paradise, his latest book, and it's Topical Currents. We'll take that break, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, and we're joined from John Glatt. He's in NPR New York. We're talking about his book, The Prince of Paradise. So how was the murder set up, and what was Narcy's involvement in it?
Well, Narcy's involvement was really as the point person. She was sharing a suite with Ben. I mean, they were running the conference. So they'd been there, in fact, two or three nights by then running this conference, and the conference was halfway through. In fact, they'd had twice as many Hispanic guests for it that they were expecting. So they were really, really busy, and they had a crew to help them. And that Saturday night, after counting the takings for the day, Ben spent all night in, there was a two-room suite. He had like turned one into an office. He spent his night on the computer, either working, tabulating all the money that they'd earned and doing other things, while Narcy was in the other room going to bed. She was, in fact, in contact with her brother Cristobal. And early that morning, I think around 4 or 5, Cristobal collected Garcia and Gonzalez, the hitmen, from a motel in Queens, which they were staying at. He drove them to the hotel where another person, Cristobal's son-in-law, was going to be the driver of the car that was going to go to the hotel, you know, for the hit. And then they kind of went to a gas station in Rye, and they waited. Now, Garcia couldn't do this horrific act sober, so they bought a bottle of rum for him, and he sat in the parking lot of this gas station drinking rum, pretty well a whole bottle of rum, to get him kind of Dutch courage to go in and murder Ben. And eventually they got the call they'd been waiting for from Narcy to give them the go-ahead. that Ben was now asleep and it was time to move in. And that's when they went in, and Cristobal was in a separate car. He wasn't going to be seen with them, and his son-in-law drove the two hitmen to the car park parking lot, dropped them off there. Then they crept upstairs, went into the Woodlands suite, which is where the Novaks were staying. When they arrived, Nasty Novak was actually holding the door open for them. They entered, and she pointed at the bedroom where Ben was finally asleep, and the two hitmen went in, one went either side of the bed, and they'd also bought dumbbells, you know, to do this beating. And they began pummeling Ben with dumbbells as hard as they could, to his head, to his face, to his chest, to his body. And I mean, he woke up to find himself under attack, and he did actually try and fight back and put up a good fight. And then while this was going on, Nasi was in the other room of the suite looking at what was happening. Mm. And at several points, it was getting really, really horrible, really, really bloody. And Garcia was doing the beating while Gonzalez got really, really worried. He went back into the other room, and Nasi ordered him back in to, you know, to help his friend beat up her husband. And this several times, Gonzalez said he was so upset about this that he went into the other room, and Nasi kept ordering him back.
She even provided him with a pillow.
That's right. She gave him a pillow to hold over Ben, saying that Ben was making too much noise, which he did. Then finally, they tied up Ben with duct tape. They hogtied him with his legs, his arms behind his back, and he was helpless and gagged him. And then Nasi ordered Garcia to cut out his eyes. Originally, the plan had been to cut off his testicles, but that had been changed, and it now was to cut out his eyes so he would survive, according to the hitmen, and be able to run the business. But in fact, poor Ben was near death when that happened, and a detective said that Garcia said, you know, lifted him up by his long, bushy hair and plunged a knife into his eyes one at a time and twisted it while Ben was still alive. Hmm. And then they carried on beating him until he was finally succumbed. Then they went back into the room and Nasi helped them wash up, you know, and by the basin. She gave them towels and stuff and they washed up. And then she saw them to the door and they went on their way.
Then she proceeded to go through a charade of helping with the breakfast for the convention.
Exactly.
And trying to have an alibi.
Exactly. Well, Nasi's big mistake was that originally, I understand that the plan had been for them to tie up Nasi and make it look like it was a robbery. But at the last minute, she'd surprised the hitmen by telling them not to do this, that they should just get away. I think maybe she was too worried after seeing what they'd done to Ben that she didn't want to be hurt. But she proceeded downstairs and she been there for 3 days. She knew where all the surveillance cameras were set, and she parked herself in front of a surveillance camera for about 10 minutes, making calls to her daughter May and to other people. And she even called Ben, Ben's cell phone, you know, to give herself an alibi.
You know, Nasi was so arrogant, having gotten away with the first murder and thinking she was going to get away with this one. Did it ever seem in your investigation that they would have gotten away with this murder?
I think, yeah. I mean, if it hadn't been for the sterling job of the Rybrook police and the state police, I think they might well have done. I mean, there wasn't any direct evidence, you know, everything was circumstantial. There was no, you know, fingerprints of Nasi's anywhere. And it took months for the police to do an investigation and to track down the hitmen and finally bring them in and get them to confess to what they'd done and point the finger at Nasi. But from the beginning, you know, when they had her in straight after the murder, they never seen anything like her. She was so arrogant, and you know, she said she was the grieving widow, and every time they tried to point the finger at her, she said, "Give me the electric chair, kill me." But there were certain things, the clues that she left behind. Now, Garcia, as I mentioned, had a very bad eye. He always wore sunglasses, and wherever he did, and while he was beating up Ben, Ben had actually punched off his sunglasses and broken them. And on the way out, Garcia had taken the glasses but left one of the arms, which was found near Ben's body. And when police asked Nasty about that, she said, these are my sunglasses. You know, they're designer sunglasses. Ben was going to fix them. But when police said, where are the rest of the sunglasses, she had no answer. So right. There were certain things that really gave her away.
So because she was convicted, where did the estate of Ben Novak go? Or what's the status of it?
Well, the status is it looks like it's going to Mayabad and Mayabad's two teenage sons. There is a big estate battle going on at the moment. I mean, Bernice's sister Maxine has lawyers, attorneys. They're trying to get some of the estate, saying it was part of the Fontainebleau estate. But also... There's other people, distant family members that have all got attorneys trying to get the estate. But at the moment, it really looks like it's going to go to Mayabad and her two teenagers.
Just for our listeners, because we're almost out of time, they were sentenced to life without parole. Is that correct, she and her brother?
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
One thing you don't mention was what happened to the actual killers, the turn state's evidence, Garcia and Gonzalez. Are they serving time?
They actually pled with the federal government. They haven't actually been sentenced yet. That's down the line. They're going to be sentenced in the next few months. But part of the deal for Garcia was that he wouldn't get charged in Florida with Bernice's murder or anything. But they're going to serve some time. But the chances are they will get out one day.
Once again, John Glad, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Thanks. It's www.johnglatt.com.
Well, we certainly want to thank you, journalist and author.
My pleasure.
John Glatt. He's told the tale of the Miami Beach Novak family, and John Glatt's book is The Prince of Paradise, The True Story of a Hotel Heir, His Seductive Wife, and a Ruthless Murder. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
And that's today's Topical Currents. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Michael Stock. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and other programs at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more information at the Topical Currents website, including links to books and authors, including today's. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. We return Thursday with an update about Women Helping Women for Habitat for Humanity, as well as Linda Gassenheimer's discussion of green kitchens. Eco-friendly, that is. And the calendar, all British. On this day in 1705, 308 years ago, Queen Anne knights Isaac Newton at Trinity College, Cambridge. Considered one of the most influential men in history, he's buried in Westminster Abbey. And on this day in 1889, 124 years ago, the birth of comedy film pioneer Charles Spencer Chaplin in London. He sang in music halls at age 5, was also a co-founder of United Artists. One more before we devolve to goon level. On this day in 1918, 95 years ago, the birth of comic genius Spike Milligan in India. Besides the goon show antics, he played piano, trumpet, and saxophone. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And so we leave with a thought from Spike Milligan, who was bipolar and had 10 nervous breakdowns. Quote, "All I ask is the chance to prove that money can't make me happy." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.